Welcome to Cleveland Clinic Cardiac Consult, brought to you by the Seidel and Arnold Miller Family Heart, Vascular, and Thoracic Institute at Cleveland Clinic.
We have another outstanding case by Dr. Harmon, which is actually very, very current. On the way here, I was looking at one of the articles. This is hot off the press, an important topic. Every day in the outpatient, I get a question, did I have a complication from the vaccine? So, Evan?
Yeah, thank you. Good morning. So my name is Evan Harmon. I'm a first-year cardiology fellow, and over the past 4 weeks, I've had the great honor of working with Dr. Klein in clinic and learning from him, and I've really enjoyed my time in the pericardial center. And as you all know, we find ourselves well over a year into the COVID-19 pandemic, and despite having efficacious vaccines available since December, roughly 50% of the population remains unvaccinated. And that hesitancy has been attributed, at least in part, to concerns over vaccine side effects, among them being myocarditis, particularly in the young. So I'm going to present two cases of both myocardial and pericardial injury attributed to mRNA COVID-19 vaccination that we saw recently here at the Cleveland Clinic. So starting with the first case, this was an 18-year-old man with no significant past medical history who presented to an outside hospital for acute onset of chest pain. He had received the second dose of his Pfizer vaccination in late April, and 2 days later developed profound intermittent pleuritic chest pain while driving that initially self-resolved, but unfortunately recurred while exercising the following day, prompting his ED presentation. In the ED, his vitals and exam were unremarkable, but as you can see, his high sensitivity troponin, proBNP, and CRP were all mildly to moderately elevated. I unfortunately don't have access to his presenting EKG, but this was documented as having diffuse ST elevations with PR depression and V1 and PR elevation and AVR. Because of the patient's symptoms, cardiac biomarkers, and the low suspicion for an acute coronary syndrome, he underwent CTPA, which was negative for pulmonary embolism or aortic pathology. He was admitted for a presumed diagnosis of acute pericarditis, and this was his initial echocardiogram shortly after his admission to the outside hospital. And in the interest of time, I've just included the parasternal short and apical four-chamber views, only to demonstrate what you can see is a mild reduction in his biventricular ejection fraction and then perhaps a trivial pericardial effusion posteriorly in the parasternal long axis view. This was resident EF of 40% at the outside hospital, and so because of that reduction in EF, there was presumed to be potentially some myocardial involvement as well, and he was started on endomethacin and colchicine for the diagnosis of an acute idiopathic myopericarditis. Because of the patient's reduction in ejection fraction and a low pretest probability of obstructive coronary disease, he subsequently underwent coronary CTA, which is negative for CAD, and his colchicine was uptitrated, followed by a cardiac MRI. Here on the left, I just included a four-chamber CNA view just to demonstrate that on this view, at least, it looks like the biventricular function is reasonably adequate. There's no obvious effusion on this particular study. And then you can see in the delayed enhancement mid-short axis view, there's no obvious contrast uptake in the myocardium. And so prior to the patient's discharge, he underwent a follow-up limited echocardiogram that also confirmed recovery of his ejection fraction, and he was ultimately discharged home on endomethacin and colchicine for the diagnosis of an acute myopericarditis, presumably due to the COVID-19 vaccine, was scheduled for follow-up with local cardiology in 8 weeks. Instead, however, the patient chose to present to the pericardial center for a second opinion regarding this diagnosis, and we found that unfortunately just 2 weeks after his discharge, he had resumed working out fairly vigorously, and in that context had been still having some ongoing intermittent chest pain following his hospital discharge on dual therapy. You can see his labs obtained in clinic that morning were unremarkable, including his inflammatory markers. He underwent a repeat echocardiogram here at the clinic, and I've included his, and those images are here on the right, both again in the sort of parasternal long and apical four-chamber views compared to those that obtained at the time of his acute illness in May. And really you can see here a more robust ejection fraction, I think, both in the RV and the LV, and then again, you don't see that sort of trivial effusion that he had on his initial echocardiogram. He also underwent cardiac MRI here at the clinic, and I just included this vertical long axis CNA image just to again sort of confirm his preserved ejection fraction. On his delayed enhancement imaging, similar to the MRI obtained at the outside hospital, again, you see no obvious contrast uptake in the myocardium. And so given his improving echocardiogram and essentially normal cardiac MRI and improving inflammatory markers, this patient was felt to have had an acute episode of myopericarditis attributable to his recent mRNA COVID vaccination. His endomethacin was exchanged for ibuprofen in keeping with AHA guidelines. His culture team was decreased, and he's planning to follow up with us this fall. The second case is a little bit more complicated, and this was a 22-year-old man with a history of myocarditis due to Coxsackie virus in November of 2019, who was presenting to us for a second opinion regarding a recent diagnosis of paramyocarditis. This patient received the first dose of his Pfizer vaccination series in April, and that same day developed headache, chills, nausea, and diarrhea, which had been well described, but more troublesome 3 days later developed an acute onset of severe chest pressure with associated diaphoresis, prompting his ED presentation. Similar to our first case, his vitals and exam were unremarkable, and you can also see that he had elevations of his cardiac and inflammatory biomarkers. Again, I don't have access to this outside hospital EKG, but this was reported as having diffuse ST elevation and, quote, suggestive of pericarditis, and his chest X-ray was negative. And given the patient's history of and a concern for recurrent myocarditis, he was transferred to a larger non-Cleveland Clinic facility for ongoing management. So shortly after his admission, he underwent an echocardiogram that was read as having a mid-range EF of 45% to 50% with global hypokinesis of the LV. And because of this concern for recurrent myocarditis, both rheumatology and infectious disease were consulted, who recommended a fairly robust lab workup. I've included these just because, interestingly, though his SARS-CoV-2 PCR testing for acute infection was negative, his IgG antibody testing against the nucleocapsid protein was positive, suggesting a previous COVID infection. And upon further questioning, the patient did recall losing his sense of taste and smell for about 3 days in the fall of 2020. And so he was presumed to have had, he was not tested at that time, but was presumed to have had an undiagnosed case of COVID-19. Also, because of his history of Coxsackie myocarditis, he had repeat titers drawn. They were actually found to be 4 times that were drawn in 2019 at the time of his illness. And ultimately, these were felt to be difficult to interpret and not particularly contributory to his acute presentation, but I thought I would include them for completeness sake. You can see he had a robust inflammatory and autoimmune workup, all of which was unrevealing, including Coxsackie PCR. Shortly after his arrival to the outside hospital in this lab workup, he had an acute recurrence of his chest pain and was transferred to the CICU for closer monitoring, and at that time was started on high-dose aspirin and colchicine therapy with resolution of his chest pain, at which time he also underwent cardiac MRI. Now, fortunately, because of this patient's history of Coxsackie myocarditis, he had a prior MRI for comparison. Here I'm showing actually just images from his the acute illness and that current admission. And here in the CNA view, you can hear see a reasonable biventricular EF and no obvious pericardial effusion in the left image. But on the right, I think you can appreciate a small pericardial effusion here, as well as some degree of mild pericardial thickening. When you compare his delayed enhancement images to that MRI in January, I think you can appreciate here we're in the basal short axis view, and we can see increased contrast uptake in the inferior lateral wall that is much more robust than was visualized about a year prior. Similarly, in the mid short axis view, you can see mid myocardial uptake throughout the interventricular septum, even extending up into the anterior wall in the epicardium, which again was much more profound than was visualized in January of 2020. And so this patient was presumed to have had an episode of acute paramyocarditis, presumably due to his recent COVID-19 vaccination. He underwent a repeat echocardiogram prior to his discharge with recovery of his ejection fraction and was ultimately discharged on colchicine monotherapy. 10 days after the hospital's patient's discharge, he followed up with his local PCP and cardiologist, who found his inflammatory markers to be mildly and persistently elevated, and for that reason, he was started on a prednisone taper as well as Coreg. And so by the time we were seeing him for second opinion at the pericardial center roughly a month later, he had completed his prednisone taper and was only on colchicine and carvedilol by that point, with improvement of his symptoms, what he felt was maybe about 90% back to baseline. His inflammatory markers from that clinic visit were unremarkable. I've included his echocardiogram here from the clinic, really just the parasternal long and short axis views just to demonstrate his robust EF and no appreciable pericardial effusion. And then on repeat cardiac MRI here at the clinic, comparing back to the time of his acute illness, you can see that in the inferior lateral wall, there is much less delayed contrast uptake compared to that study in April. And similarly, when you look in the mid-short axis view, there is much less contrast uptake in the mid-myocardial wall and the anterior wall and epicardium that was viewed in that previous study. And so with this patient's normal echocardiogram and approving cardiac MRI and inflammatory biomarkers, this patient was felt to have had a resolving episode of acute paramyocarditis due to his mRNA COVID vaccination. His colchicine was decreased from twice daily to once daily. He was counseled on exercise reduction and weight loss, and he too will follow up with us this fall. And so just how common is this? You know, before I talk a little bit about that, I just wanted to give just a brief timeline, and I'll try to be quick with this, just to kind of give an idea of how we ended up here today. And so, as you all know, the mRNA, Pfizer and Moderna vaccines were approved for emergency use in December of 2020. And it was just 2 months later that the first presumed case of vaccine-related myocarditis was reported. And this was actually first reported in the lay press. This particular headline actually came from the Jerusalem Post. And over the months of March and April, multiple governing bodies, including the CDC, WHO, and the Israeli Ministry of Health, would continue to monitor ongoing cases of presumed vaccine-related pericarditis and myocarditis. In parallel to that, though, was a randomized study by Pfizer looking at the vaccination in 12 to 15-year-old adolescents. And given a reassuring safety profile, the FDA extended the emergency use authorization to patients as low as 12 years of age, which at the time, and given the ongoing reports of myocarditis and pericarditis, was met with both praise and some controversy. Less than a month later, the Israeli Ministry of Health released their own statement regarding cases they had observed in Israel following Pfizer vaccination in myocarditis and pericarditis, and overall felt that these patients, these cases were quite rare and mostly self-limiting. Meanwhile, in the United States, however, there continue to be ongoing reports in both the pediatric and adult literature of vaccine-related myocarditis and pericarditis, which ultimately culminated in the CDC releasing a formal statement earlier this month. And in the CDC's data, they found that of the 296 million doses of mRNA COVID vaccine given since December, 52 million of those have been given to patients 12 to 29 years old. And despite all of those vaccine doses, there had only been 1,226 reports of pericarditis and myocarditis since that time. You can see they found that the vast majority of these cases occurred after the second dose of the mRNA vaccine with a male predominance and mostly patients under 30. Looking closer at data from the Vaccine Safety Data Link and confirmed cases of myocarditis and pericarditis following vaccination, the CDC found that the case rate was only 12.6 cases per million second doses of mRNA vaccine given, so obviously quite low and reassuring. But why did this happen? And I think the short answer right now is that we don't know, but there have been some mechanisms proposed. I think the most popular of those proposed mechanisms is this is likely a dysregulated autoimmune and inflammatory response in genetically susceptible hosts. And so if you remember, the mRNA vaccine works by packaging mRNA encoded for the key SARS-CoV-2 spike protein into lipid nanoparticles, or LNPs. These are injected intramuscularly and taken up by antigen-presenting cells like dendritic cells, which then translate the mRNA into that spike protein and stimulate T lymphocytes. The real key of mRNA vaccination, of course, is its ability to stimulate not only CD4 lymphocytes, but also cytotoxic CD8 T cells. And so in this way, the mRNA vaccines are able to generate a robust immune response utilizing both the antibody-mediated and cytotoxic and cell-mediated immune pathways. Unfortunately, the mRNA itself can act as an immunogenic trigger in some individuals, and it's felt that some patients may be particularly susceptible to this phenomenon, essentially resulting in a profound inflammatory response and cytokine release that can be damaging to the myocardium and pericardium. Also keep in mind that the mRNA is frequently genetically modified to preserve its integrity given its inherent instability, and sometimes those mRNA modifications themselves can stimulate an immunogenic response in some patients. Another mechanism that's been proposed is this may be an eosinophilic hypersensitivity reaction to the vaccine. This is based primarily on the idea that the lipid nanoparticles themselves have multiple components to maintain their integrity and stability, and one of those being polyethylene glycol, which has been implicated as the potential trigger of anaphylactic reactions to the vaccine in other patients. Other authors have noted that patients who seem to suffer this complication frequently seem to be quote-unquote primed either by an initial dose of the vaccine or by a prior COVID-19 infection. And so that has given some rise to the idea of a hypersensitivity reaction. And then finally, we know that other vaccines, most notably the live smallpox vaccine, have caused eosinophilic myocarditis in the past as well. I would say that I think overall this is felt to be a less likely mechanism, primarily because One, many of these patients who have presented following COVID-19 vaccination have not had a profound peripheral eosinophilia. They also, to my knowledge, there's been no case reports demonstrating endomyocardial biopsy evidence of eosinophilic infiltrate in the myocardium. And then also many cases of eosinophilic myocarditis are typically quite profound and have severe outcomes, and the majority of these cases have been quite mild, but certainly it's an ongoing area of investigation. So how do these patients present? When you look at the cohort of confirmed cases reviewed by the CDC, the median age was 19 years with a male predominance. Most patients present within a week of symptoms, and very many present with this within 2 to 3 days of their vaccination. Of those confirmed cases, almost all the patients were hospitalized, but to date there's been no reported deaths in that confirmed cohort of patients. I've included here just the CDC definitions of probable and definitive confirmed acute myocarditis, as well as acute pericarditis and myopericarditis. I've included this mainly just to reiterate that a key feature, obviously, of this diagnosis is that we still need to be thinking about other causes of myopericarditis in these patients before attributing their symptoms purely to the mRNA vaccines. So what diagnostic workup should we perform? Obviously, history is incredibly important in teasing out potential alternative etiologies. Troponin and proBNP are helpful, and as a reminder, in the case of at least myocarditis, troponin does not correlate with heart failure and arrhythmia development, but does correlate with ECMO requirement and mortality, and so can be helpful in these patients. Inflammatory markers can be supportive of the diagnosis, and certainly the EKG is helpful with ST elevations and PR depressions in the case of pericarditis, and more nonspecific ST changes, T wave inversions, and arrhythmia and myocarditis. All these patients probably should have at least a baseline simple autoimmune workup, including ANA and rheumatoid factor, but certainly should have a low threshold of involving our rheumatology colleagues in these sort of undifferentiated cases. Obviously, COVID testing, both PCR and antibody testing, can be helpful. And then to that end, the utility of a very robust workup like we saw in our second patient is unclear. I think that probably the most helpful are typically peripheral-based PCR tests that are targeted based on the patient's specific risk factors. And obviously the diagnostic standard being endomyocardial biopsy with viral culture and PCR, but that in the age of multimodality cardiac imaging is becoming, I think, less and less pursued. To that end, I've just included some of the common findings you may see in both echocardiogram and cardiac MRI in these cases. I'll just note for echocardiogram specifically that in the cases of myocarditis, at least biventricular dysfunction is a particularly poor prognostic sign. Fortunately, many of the cases of, related to the COVID-19 vaccine present with a preserved ejection fraction, which is reassuring. And then with regard to cardiac MRI, certainly there's hyperemia, edema, necrosis, and scar of what, like the Louise Lake criteria that can be helpful. But really, I think CMR in many of these cases is utilized as a second line imaging modality to either support or verify a diagnosis as suspected that is not clearly confirmed by history, labs, and imaging. In terms of management, the backbone really is still NSAIDs and colchicine and corticosteroids in patients who are either NSAID intolerant or symptoms prove refractory to dual therapy. We should be counseling these patients obviously on alcohol avoidance and exercise restriction for at least the 3 months following their diagnosis. And appropriate heart failure and arrhythmia management obviously is important in patients in which those complications arise, though I will say in the available case reports of COVID vaccine-related myocarditis and pericarditis, these seem to be very rare. Finally, there have been case reports utilizing both IV steroids and IVIG, but I would say to this point, data supporting their use is limited. Finally, just to end here, I did want to just provide an overall risk-benefit analysis provided by the CDC. So using the CDC's data, when they look at the benefits of COVID vaccination, particularly benefits conferred by a second dose of an mRNA vaccine, when you look at COVID cases prevented, hospitalizations prevented, ICU admissions and deaths prevented, and weigh that against the risk of myocarditis developing within 7 days of a second dose of an mRNA vaccine, that data can be broken down here by sex and age. And I just want to draw your attention here to this particularly high-risk cohort of young adult males. And even in this really high-risk cohort, you can see that the number of cases, hospitalizations, ICU admissions, and deaths prevented by full COVID-19 vaccination seems to far outweigh the risk of expected myocarditis. So just to summarize, myocarditis following mRNA COVID-19 vaccination seems to be a very rare, mild, and mostly self-limiting phenomenon. It does tend to occur in young male patients following the second dose of the vaccine. The diagnosis can be challenging and obviously requires a fairly comprehensive assessment. The treatment is oftentimes supported with NSAID and colchicine therapy, and many of these patients, even those who are hospitalized, typically have very short lengths of stay on those therapies. And obviously, future work should focus not only on continuing to monitor these cases going forward for long-term side effects, but I think also continuing to tease out the actual mechanism of its occurrence with aims at potentially preventing this complication in the future. And that's all I had. Thank you.
Great, Evan. That was fabulous, very timely, and very current. I had a case yesterday, a possible case that actually was a woman. Doesn't fit the spectrum, but had the vaccine and went. I was in London, England, and had a bad case of mild pericarditis, and actually is on anakinra. So this is this is interesting. But let's ask the panel. Let me start with Dr. Tang, who's an expert in heart failure. Should you get the second shot? In other words, they've had this reaction. What are the risks and benefits, and anything about mechanism?
Yeah, great question. No clear answer, but I think nature did help us here because the majority of cases are actually after the second dose. In fact, I think in the Israeli data, it's only like 10 per million. I think it's in the or 7 per million is in the first dose. So there are some patients that do have also non-specific symptom that mimic myocarditis usually do present to us, but in general, most people's recommendation right now is to let the entire symptom resolve and had a shared decision making regarding the risk and had some closer monitoring. So I think currently we still recommend having the second dose. Now that's maybe a little different with the allergic reaction, which I don't think you mentioned. There are some people who have severe allergic reaction, tryptase goes sky high, really anaphylactic, well, less of anaphylactic, but a lot of swelling. And I think there's even some recent data from a multi-center evaluation, I think only presented this week, that many of them after some resolution is safe to get the second dose too. So short answer is yes, we still, particularly with the complete resolution. Now, the challenge is if somebody truly get cardiac dysfunction, that is a very different story, and we do have to manage them aggressively.
Also, Wilson, I know in some countries they mix and match the vaccine. So if somebody got one shot and got the myocarditis, should they get the AstraZeneca or the J&J vaccine, which doesn't have the mRNA?
That is actually also not very clear. I do not know exactly the data that was done mainly in Europe regarding the mixed vaccines. I do know that they do elicit different kind of elements of immune responses. We know that in, say, the immunocompromised patients getting booster shots. So I think in general, vaccine-associated myocarditis, as Evan mentioned, there are literally two components. And the component about the preservatives, the PEGs and all this, may be of interest when you actually counsel patients. That's why when we actually have, when we get our vaccine, we will ask about whether we have previous allergies. And also we try to space out the vaccines. As you remember, we cannot have vaccines within 1 month of another vaccine. So those are just precautions. But in general, I do think that we don't know enough to comment on that. That being said, it is very rare. I mean, there's literally a paper yesterday in preprint using electronic medical record consortiums and found out that COVID myocarditis itself, which is another enigma, is at least 6 times higher than the actual vaccine related. So I think we have to kind of really understand the denominator and numerator. And the second thing is, it is much more risky in the young male population, whereas the female and other cohorts, elderly patients, are more of the related to more autoimmune mechanisms.
Great. Let me ask Dr. Johnson Kwan, just what you said, Wilson, the COVID-19 and MRIs. An athlete, is it overcalled, undercalled? How do you make that diagnosis? I know we have a little series that when we repeat the MRI here, we don't find much. So was it overcalled in the community? So Christine and Debbie?
Oh, I think it's a difficult question. I'm not sure if Debbie's got any great answer, probably much better than me. I think sometimes the beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and sometimes we interpret studies differently in different places. But I think we have to be careful about the decisions that we make and the reports that we generate, particularly with MRI, and particularly, sorry, that's my pager going off, because these are young people, you know, who are, they're college kids who are on athletic scholarships. They've got potential careers and livelihoods ahead of them. And so whatever we do, we really want to make sure that we get it right. And I think that's the beauty of working in a place like this, where, you know, we're very thoughtful in how we analyze these images. It's often, as was mentioned before, sort of team, very much a team approach, discussing it with our sports cardiologists, our imaging staff, and really making sure that we get it right and we craft those reports so that they're clinically relevant, as well as having all the radiology information. But I think it's a really difficult area. I'll handball to Debbie, see what she says.
Yeah, it's a very intriguing topic. We're getting a lot more referrals for patients with COVID, especially with the long haulers. There's a lot of patients who continue to have persistent symptoms. I'd say probably, again, echoing what Christine said, it's really, it's kind of subjective in the sense that you can have T1 and T2 elevation, but that doesn't necessarily definitively mean they have myocarditis, because you can have, especially in the more acute situation, you have hyperemia. Does hyperemia mean direct myocardial infection of the virus? That's really what's uncertain at this point. But I think the last case that you showed, where there's significant delayed hyper enhancement, no one would argue that that's myocarditis. That's pretty clear cut. That was actually a very striking case to me, because that was a significant amount of late gadolinium enhancement. Most of the patients that we're seeing that come in with questionable myocarditis, it's very subtle T1, T2 changes and maybe a subtle LGE, but that person had a significant amount. So the question is, I'd say the amount of patients that we see like that are probably in the single digits in terms of percentage. But the question is, what are the long-term implications? Like, this person has normal ejection fraction, but when he did the follow-up MRI, he still had persistent LGE. And there's literature and non-COVID myocarditis, but just, you know, any other kind of viral myocarditis, showing that people who have persistent LGE have increased risk for adverse events. So these patients still have to be followed. I mean, they're in the, you know, their LV function is normal, but what's going to happen to them long term? So they're going to have to follow up with cardiology and have repeat imaging down the line. I think we still don't really know what this means in terms of long term implications.
Alan, can I ask a question? I think we're seeing the issue of vaccine hesitancy, and now we're seeing increasing numbers again. And I'm certainly getting my chart messages from patients who've got a history of pericarditis, who are concerned and have put off having their vaccination, worrying because they're hearing all these things in the media. And so it's certainly reassuring to let them know that these are rare cases and that they're at risk for myopericarditis from the virus itself. But I just bring it up because I think we're going to continue to get these types of questions, and while we have the panel here, to see how people are approaching this, because a lot of these patients are young men in their 20s who've had a history of pericarditis, and they have a legitimate reason to ask that question, I think.
That's very true. A lot of my chart messages get asked about this. I think if you've had pericarditis, I still think the getting the vaccine is the benefit that outweighs the risk of the myocarditis. The other question is, some people are on all these anti-inflammatories, you know, including anakinra, rilonacept, and what's the effect of the vaccine with all these anti-inflammatories? Is it less effective? We don't really know. Should these be getting boosters as well in the future? So there's a lot unknown in this field, but it's a very dynamic field. The other thing is, with exercise, some of these are Division I athletes, some are professional players. And Debbie, if they have that, you know, sort of scarring in the heart or edema in the heart, what do you tell them in terms of their professional career? The big stakes, big money, you know, and these are young people. So these are tough things.
I think it's similar for myocarditis too. I think Sean and Danny at our pediatric cardiology group has been very interested in this question and actually has observed that several people with history of myocarditis seem to have uneventful course after, you know, getting their vaccine. So I think it's, again, just what I said before, the risk and benefits and the overall protection does outweigh, and many of these cases are treatable and manageable. I think back to what Debbie was saying, the second case has a history of Coxsackie myocarditis. So there's been kind of the multi-hit hypothesis, not only genetic and also prior immune, like immune, you know, dysfunction that is kind of manifested with this type of reaction, both for the vaccine and for viral infections.
So, Seven, you have the last word. You did the research on this area. It's very intriguing, literature review and what's going, and I'm sure there's an article every day in the journals. Any comments about this field now?
I think that everything that's important has been said. I just think it's a, you know, a very complex question, and I think really just speaks to sort of the dynamic nature of not only the SARS-CoV-2 virus itself, but also find a way to use this vaccine and be transparent with patients, but also reassuring that it does still seem, I think, in my opinion, that vaccination overall does seem to outweigh risk. Obviously, I understand there's more complex and unique cases that maybe need more thought and attention.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. We welcome your comments and feedback. Please contact us at heart@ccf.org. Like what you heard? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or listen at clevelandclinic.org/cardiacconsultpodcast.